alcohol.com podcast. Today we are talking about Bill and Ted Face the Music and trilogies in general. So go around, introduce yourself, say if the you of when Bill and Ted first came out was brought to a mall of today, what would you think? I'm Marissa, and I would think, what is an escape room, and why do so many malls have them now?
I'm Jesse, and wouldn't I just think, why are all the stores closed? Why are the doors locked?
I mean,
why are
all valid. Those
dying people inside? We were locked inside of a mall recently, and it was weird, so I'm not...
being in a mall is weird.
Being in a mall is weird, just in general.
I'm Nathaniel, and I think I'd be like, what happened to the KB Toys? What happened?
They were going out of business for so long.
Where's the B. Dalton?
Walden Books.
I'm Rob, and I would think they must be closing this down to knock it down and build a bigger mall. That's the only explanation.
With even more escape rooms.
Yeah, it's an all escape room mall. You just escape from room to room.
So Bill and Ted Face the Music, we should say up top, kudos to them for bringing it to VOD. Anyone could watch it without fear of being coughed on.
A nice event movie for the home, rather than
Bill and Ted
hastily
really do care about us all.
Yes.
I feel like there's a spectrum of opinion about this, and I want to start with probably the most positive, so we'll start with Nathaniel.
Yeah, I loved this movie. I adored it. I think that, so many times I feel like I've seen people being like, this is the movie we need right now, or like, this is the movie this moment needs, you know, or I just really needed it. I'm sure that's true for me. You know, it was just like a really lovely, warm, fun, positive movie at a time when it felt like a real balm. And I think also I also just really had a lot of like goodwill toward it because of the fact that they were the one big movie that I was really excited about, who were like, you know what, we're just like not going to make you risk your health to see this movie. We're going to let you see it at home. But also it turned out, because, you know, we watched Excellent Adventure and Bogus Journey in like the week before this one came out, and it like turned out I was like a real big Bill and Ted guy that I didn't really know I identified myself as such, you know, just kind of apropos of nothing. But, you know, I'd purchased the collector's set of the first two movies, and
there were signs, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And I think growing up in Arizona, when I did, that you have an automatic affection for the original, because though it's set in San Dimas, California, they shot a lot of it in Tempe, in Phoenix. The mall is the mall my wife is most familiar with in her life. The skating rink that they slide on at the end of that sequence is the skating rink that she skated on, you know, hundreds of times. The water park that Napoleon goes to is my Sunsplash in Tempe, Arizona. So when he goes up to the top, I'm like, I know that freeway. I know the, interior of that slide. You know, the Circle K looks, I don't know that specific Circle K, but I know those Circle Ks, you know, I always had that kind of baseline affection for it. But then watching it again, I was like, oh, I have this movie. This is one of those movies where each line I'm saying it in my head before it happens. It's really burned in there. And watching it again, I was I really was struck this first movie, I am of the opinion that it's one of those perfect comedies. It really is it's such a kind of singular, strange thing. It's it's not visually as, you know, visionary as Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but to me it's in that category of taking a sketch character, in this case sketch characters not played by these actors originally, but the writers, and creating a movie around it that is just so Bill and Ted as characters are enough, they're funny. You could just do a high school comedy with them. And then the story they decided to tell with these characters is just so perfect. And they really make such good use of the time travel. They really explore without doing kind of the obvious thing that I think was discusses the original pitch of Bill and Ted are responsible for everything bad that happens in history or something. You know, they go back and they accidentally sink the Titanic, or, you know, they... invite Lincoln to the play, you know, to Our American Cousin or, you know, whatever. Instead of doing that, they just like said, no, we want to just like kind of see a scene of Billy the Kid and Socrates playing catch and like kind of explored pretty much everything else you could do with it. The like time travel mechanic of the scene at the police station near the end of that movie is one that is like so kind of bonehead obvious, which is perfect for those guys. And that also is something I don't really recall seeing in another movie and is just like delightfully executed of them kind of using the fact that there's time travel to get them out of this predicament. So that's all to say that the first movie, it turned out I like really revered the first movie. And I also really love Bogus Journey. Like, I think that it's like between the two of them are kind of a like perfect, wonderful little diptych of comedies, where Bogus Journey is great in it, like Bill and Ted are still wonderful in it, and it conveys a lot of the similar spirit of the first movie, but it also is great in ways that are very different from the first movie, and as a movie it's so different. So this third one, I was like excited for it, and as it was about to come out, it was when finally the apprehension for me hit of like, oh no, it turns out I really am like, it turns out I'm a Bill and Ted guy. And what if this one is a bummer? Because it's, you know, like 30 years later, it's easy to imagine not having the recipe correct. You know, like the Dumb and Dumber sequel, you know, Carrie and Jeff Daniels are still funny, but the tone is just not quite right. It's like a little curdled, a little sour in ways that it, you know, made it not as fun. So that's a long way of saying that this one, I was like really relieved and delighted that like, for me, it really hit. And it like, I loved that it's not wholly different in the way that like Bogus Journey was from Excellent Adventure. And in some ways it really feels like them saying like, we're turning this into a trilogy. Like, it was two kind of comedies sat next to each other that, you know, like informed each other, but were also equally strange and fun. But this one, in ways that kind of tie in with the ultimate kind of solution of the dilemma that they all face, and something that Bill and Ted say to their daughters explicitly, that they kind of like look at things they like and kind of mix stuff together. And so this one has time travel, and it has like some of the fun of Excellent Adventure in what happens with the girls, the daughters. And then it also has Bill and Ted facing like alternate versions of themselves and a killer robot and existential danger and literally going to hell and all of that stuff. That's, you know, very kind of riffing on similar ideas to Bogus Journey, but it also doesn't do the Austin Powers thing of just saying like, here's the joke template and we're doing another run through it. Actually just read today something like with Ed Solomon, one of the writers, saying like, we actually didn't go back and look at the first two movies. And like, for a while I was thinking that was probably like, I was kind of regretting that and thinking like, oh, maybe I should have. But then in retrospect, now I think it's probably good that we didn't just like, that we like wrote the movie that for like the middle-aged guys we are now, not trying to like say, okay, let's do another, you know, trip to the water park, or let's, you know, like repeat the, you know, kind of joke structure, and just change which historical figure it is or something like that. So yeah, like this one really to me felt like kind of a synthesis of the first two in a way that turns this into a trilogy and like a pretty satisfying trilogy of movies, while also just being like pretty thoroughly delightful itself. So that's my 10 minutes on Face the Music. What did you guys think?
You know, the middle age thing is something I really did connect with and about this movie, and because I am also middle aged. And it's not that I had a super strong connection to the movies when I was a kid. I saw Bogus Journey when it came on video. I believe New Year's Eve is when I watched it, 1991. That's later, you know, 6 months after whatever it came out. I saw it before I saw Excellent Adventure, and I didn't catch up with Excellent Adventure until Marissa made me watch it. You know, maybe 10 years ago. And then we rewatched both of them in the run up to this. So I like both of them.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I mean, I saw the better one, Bogus Journey, first. I had affection for them, but it wasn't like ingrained in me. But I was struck watching this movie how well Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter and the writers bring these characters into middle age, which is such a, I think, a hard thing to do because they're already kind of pushy and bogus dirty, these guys. So I think they like age them up enough so they're not quite teenagers in that movie. I don't think they're kind of college age or maybe.
Yeah, they're like in their early 20s.
And it's tricky to like keep that. It's a very clear archetype character, but also very era specific, I think. And then to try to like see what those guys are up to 30 years later and try to make that make sense in 2020 or let's just call it 2019. I feel like this is where this movie's actually set. Is so tricky. And both Reeves and Winter do such a good job, I think, of keeping the kind of very familiar, like what's funny about Bill and Ted, they're like very distinctive vocal patterns and tone, but it somehow doesn't feel exactly like they're just doing the same thing 30 years later. They're
right.
Just like exact guys. There are little notes of like melancholy and sadness and disappointment in them, especially in Ted, which
yeah.
makes sense. Like, which makes sense. Reeves is a very good actor and his persona has sort of changed over the years. It's not as, you know, merry, let's say, as he seems. And when he can, I mean, because Bill and Ted is one of the first really big things he was in. And I think Reeves does a really wonderful job bringing that sense out, the like sense of like they are middle-aged guys. They still are kind of that dim sensibility and sort of like gee whiz sensibility, but there is something that feels authentically aged about them, which I think was really cool. And Nathaniel and I were talking about this.
When we're talking about long gap sequels,
yeah,
our two criteria are always does it wrestle with the passage of time, and did one of the characters grow a beard? And Keanu Reeves actually shaved his beard, so negative points.
I get why he did, but I think this movie makes up for it by giving you lots of alternate Bill and Teds who are made up in different goofy ways. And well
played, yes, you get some real good beards.
And yeah, like that even that as they encounter these different versions of themselves, that Bill is generally pretty genial towards his alternate self. And Ted has like real problems with some of them, and they are, some of them are jerks, but like even when they're, this is I guess a spoiler, but they at one point counter themselves as very elderly men, and Bill is just like super happy to see himself, and Ted is like, I'm sorry we never really connected.
Like, yeah, just, so Bill is explicitly saying like, I'm sorry I let you down, Bill, and younger Bill's like, you never did. And then Ted is like having this kind of like real meeting of like, I just never opened myself up to you, man. I'm sorry.
And that stuff, very good. I actually found the end, like the way it sort of resolves the like writing the song that unites the world thing, like I wouldn't say clever, but like satisfying and sweet. And I found the movie, you know, sweet and likable. I also felt watching it that it's got like, okay, so I don't think the first movie is like wildly funny. I think it's like loopy and charming. And I think the second one is solidly very funny, and it reminded me of Michel Gondry when I rewatched it because of like the, you know, sort of whimsical weirdness of it. I like pictured a young Michel Gondry, or at least somewhere younger Michel Gondry, watching this movie and being like, yes, this is what I want movies to be like. And this movie, I think Nathaniel's right that it does kind of synthesize the two, you know, the sort of areas that these two movies, the earlier two movies, operate in. But just on a filmmaking level, I feel there's a lot of dead air in this movie, and I was kind of puzzled by some of it. I mean, like, I like the kind of mechanics of the plot that sends Bill and Ted on one adventure going into the future to try to steal the great song, because they have only a limited amount of time to finish the song and have not come up with it yet. I love the prog experiments that they're like clearly noodling around with in a vain attempt to write such a great song. That's a great detail. And then they also send their daughters, who are wonderfully played by the two actors who are cast as young Ted and young Bill, on their own separate thing, collecting musicians to be like their backing band. But the kind of rhythm of it, it has this weird kind of thudding, like one, you know, it's Bill and Ted going, okay, let's try like a few years ahead of the future. Oh, that didn't work. Let's try three more. Now let's try five more. It's just like, and some of those encounters are funny, but often it kind of amounts to Bill and Ted approaching the other Bill and Ted and kind of having an awkward conversation. And I don't know, it doesn't have the like kind of, I don't know, the pacing or something it to me felt very off. And so either
you're saying dead air, but like here it didn't have that, because I was laughing at every exchange they had. Like I found every time they met an older Bill and Ted to be really funny. Like all like those exchanges that you described, it is just them kind of like seeing each other and being like, like, you jerks, to like give us this, like, why didn't you just go write the song yourself? Like, we don't have it. But Reeves and Winter are, I just think are really so funny as each of the like iterations of Bill and Ted. Like, Winter does like this kind of hip swivel as the fake British Bill that I was like chuckling about the next day. And like Ted as prison Ted, when the robot, the villainous robot shows up, the semi villainous robot shows up, prison Ted is just like, "You want some Bill and Ted?" Before they start pummeling him. And it was like all those like little bits of performance. Like, it's really just, especially for Keanu Reeves as an actor who's like so often like described as being a kind of limited actor, and Alex Winter, who just like doesn't act that much. It was just like so fun to see them doing all that stuff that like there was, like, for me, there was no dead air in any of those scenes because they were all very funny.
I think the performances are very funny, but I don't like, I think there's, I don't know, it's weird because the director made Galaxy Quest, which is a perfectly like well-built comedy, and this, I just didn't feel like there was any sense of like building. Like, there would usually be for me a big laugh when you see what the guys are up to, and then some smaller laughs as you sort of have their exchange. But there's no like, the comic tension though in those scenes just felt so like kind of messy and diffuse to me. Like, it's never, it like, it doesn't, like you said, talk about them coming from a sketch character, and it really is amazing that they're able to make these three movies out of like very sketch. They're, you know, these movies were connected with Wayne's World very much, and it's like it's amazing that there were these three movies made out of this like thing you would expect to see on SNL or whatever, of like the two California dudes using their slang and like, and
yeah, it's like the sketch built around something you do with your buddy, which is it's like
the Solomon Californians, and but good. But there were moments in that where I kind of felt like, oh yeah, I'm watching the like the reunion sketch show that's like a little clunky, and you know, it's like set in a bunch of hallways, and like, you just didn't have the like, you know, when it kind of comes together with what the, there's just like a lot of mechanics instead of a lot of fun. I felt even more so because you don't have Winter and Reeves doing different variations. The daughters, who again, I thought were terrific. So, so good performances and such a fun like idea of what Bill and Ted Daughters would be like. But their kind of interactions with the historical / you know, most historical or fake historical music figures that they're collecting, it's just, again, like, there would be like kind of a nice smile or laugh when you see what they're doing, but there wasn't like a sense of like, I don't know, they didn't have those weird kind of ping-ponging combinations like the way the historical figures all go to the mall and pair off and do this different zany.
That's true, but that thread did have one of my favorite moments in the movie, which is the Jimi Hendrix Mozart sequence, like the where he like Hendrix lures Mozart out by playing along with him. I really loved that scene.
I kind of liked all of the movies like less and less as they've gone on, so I feel like we all have like a different ranking of them. And I think it's definitely, hearing you guys talk, your mileage may vary in terms of like what's funny and what's not, because I hated that robot. But for me, it's all about like the first one is rooted in something really recognizable, like a metalhead himbo doesn't want to do history report, you know, just wants to play music and isn't even really that good at it because they don't want to practice either. Like, that is like very rooted in something real to me. And then the second one is like about them going into heaven to like kidnap an alien. And I'm like, this is like no longer something that I can really connect to as a human thing anymore. And I feel like the idea from the first movie that Bill and Ted would like go on to become experts in all types of music and be able to like name drop theremin players, it's not really how I would see those characters aging or grappling with their aging. It doesn't feel like an error, but it's just not the direction that I wanted it to go. I'm not done complaining. So then, and then plus you add in their wives, who are like totally tossed this like nothing C-level plot and recast to be 10 years younger, and I feel like they kind of like mess with what the mechanics of their time travel is with the wives. Like, are we in a multiverse now? And then the daughters, I did agree that all these performances were like really excellent, but I don't think that daughters growing up today in that kind of like airy environment would be Bill and Ted copies in the same way, and also experts about music.
Well, I really like that they're, I like the daughter's fandom so much, because Bill and Ted are not experts in music in Excellent Adventure. They have like a very narrow
set they're of like, not, they don't like. Even really know how to play their instruments.
Yeah, and to have, they have these daughters who are like such fans of both Bill and Ted in general, and just like the history of music. I thought That's it was true. Like
I
really,
I think like
really
the positivity
sweet.
Is like the thing that I like most about the series. Just like, especially in the first Bill and Ted, they like, every time they meet someone, they open with a compliment. They're like, even in like the second one, they're like, you're both excellent works or whatever.
Yeah. Well, they're very positive characters, which is
so I like that. But I feel like the first time the daughters talked, I kind of like saw how the whole thing was gonna play out, like I guess the ending.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't really like a wonderful ride for me to get there, even though I also agree that the multiple scenes where they're talking to each other are funny. And it kind of reminded me of in Bogus Journey when Alex Winter plays like his demon grandmother. Like, that's like an underrated bit of acting because he was like so good in that too.
Yeah,
they're both really, really deceptively strong actors, and it kind of made me wish I had seen Winter and more. You know, he had done more things over the years. Keanu,
like I said,
obviously,
I hate
busy.
Station more than anything. Like, I feel like that is like such a thing that only boys like, or it's like some kind of thing that only says its own name in a stupid tone of voice, and you could say the same thing, and maybe that would make you funny. I don't know. I just don't get it. And then the robot is like the Station.
The Station. That's one of the things that made me think of Michel Gondry, the kind of inexplicable and like whimsically positive, even though it's kind of, you know, gross. Is I was like, oh, that seems like Gondry-esque.
Rob, but I did like Death.
Yeah. Oh, he's
Death is always funny.
He is really very funny. And one scene I thought did actually kind of land as like an actual comic set piece was when the daughters go and negotiate with Death
to coax him into
address his grievances with the band, which I thought was very funny. But even that sequence, the hell sequence, to me felt like overcrowded by the time you're adding in the robot and Ted's dad and Bill and Ted and their daughters and Death and it reminded me a little bit of the Indiana like the last bit of the Indiana Jones movie where there's suddenly it's a group field trip instead of like the kind of cleaner thing. But Rob, I don't actually know anything about how you feel about Bill and Ted, because this is not a movie we ever watched together, sort of, surprisingly. And you watched them all, I think, this week. You'd seen them before, though.
Oh, I get to talk now? I have been waiting for so long. You guys have no idea. So, I didn't know that about you, Jesse, but also, I came to Bogus Journey first. And like, I had seen some of it on video, but I remember when like I first saw commercials and trailers for Excellent Adventure, I'm like I don't know, 9, but even I can tell that like this it just watching those, like it just felt like, oh, it's just trying to comp this thing about culture that I only know from like watching TV, and you know, kind of how they talked, like it kind of put me off. Then I saw some of the movie. And then, like, I saw Bogus Journey in the theaters. And I don't
me too, Rob.
And I don't know how me and my father came to that.
I'm picturing Hawk regarding this movie.
He liked it.
Oh, wow.
He liked it, man. And also, like Bogus Journey, like, at the time, like, even then, like, everything that Marissa doesn't like about it, I'm like, yeah. That's the stuff. Like, I had never seen The Seventh Seal, but I was like, something is going on here based on other parodies of something about a Grim Reaper that I've seen that, like, I don't know. And yeah, so like, it really resonated with me. And Excellent Adventure is something that has kind of worked itself into. I should say it did in the before times when we used to go to an office, and we would do pizza and movie Fridays. And that was something that everybody could agree on. And you know, yes, yeah, is quite enjoyable, but yeah, I probably still was like a little more probably preferred Bogus Journey just because it's just so far out there. And I really like this movie too. I think I am closer on the Nathaniel spectrum of takes here, but I would also acknowledge that like there's definitely some mitigating circumstances. For example, there is a worldwide plague that means we can't leave our houses, and anything that's like divorced from the reality of that and is also very positive is going to feel good. Also, you know, when we were talking about the New Mutants, this is a movie everybody can go see. So I would just say go see it. So I don't want to spoil it too much, but like also, you know, being cooped up in quarantine with my very young children who, I've done, so far, they haven't turned on me yet. They're 2.5. And like, you know, like my, you know, like my son can name every Bowie record on site just by looking at it. At least the ones that I own. I own most of them. And like, it's still like into the music that I like a lot of that stuff probably over resonated with me with the daughters. Yeah. I just, you know, I was laughing the whole time, you know, I felt really good. I thought the hell stuff was great. Like, I think like the stuff with the Reaper, was probably the hardest I laughed. You know, I think the stuff with the daughters was great, but the stuff where like they like he's trying to like hash it out with Bill and Ted about like, why about like their history of lawsuits and stuff. I just
I can come around it. You now is the yeah. The restraining like order ended.
We didn't want to 40-minute bass solos. He's like those were the only good parts of the show. That whole thing, the only thing that came close to me laughing that hard at the beginning was Bill and Ted telling their entire relationship to Missy. that was amazing. But so yeah, you know, it's just like it's so warm, and it was like a movie where it's like Ted was practically like a Mary Sue for me. Like I could and the other circumstance is just where Keanu Reeves is at, like in his career, where it just feels like now more than ever he has kind of like a handle on who he is and what he does really well. Because it's like I hardly ever see movies in the theaters anymore, but I have seen the last two John Wick movies with two other dads who also hardly ever go to the movies anymore.
Yeah, that's a voting block. The Wick dads,
they're
breaking for Biden.
I do think that the current situation of the world has like worked against me for this movie, because I mean I understand like get it like wanting comfort television comfort movies, but for me being like the world is so bad out there, something a song like in the key of C in the tempo of Obla Di Obla Da is like not gonna fix things. You know, like so it almost made me angry.
But that was the genius thing, because it's not about the song,
right?
It's about everybody.
No, but
not
like,
worrying
do you think
about
that you could walk out into the streets of our unrest and get people from different points of view to just play the tambourine together, and our world problems are solved?
I think if a time traveler that looked like Keanu Reeves came up to me and handed me a keyboard and was like, "Only play the white keys," yeah, I think it would work.
I think that was an elegant solution to the problem all movies about great songs or great,
yeah. Well,
like,
I
fictional
think
that
great
it's
songs a problem
have.
That this movie created, because at the end of the last one, you had like all those newspaper articles that said that they
That's
did
true.
It,
you don't
and then they undo
the
it, and then you.
Okay, wait. Because I waited half an hour to talk, I feel I can interrupt now.
Yes,
that was perfect, because first of all, it explained that away. That was like, yeah, everybody liked that concert, but that clearly wasn't the song. And you can tell because of what happened in like the newspaper articles that we're going to show you that happened after the newspaper articles at the end of Bogus Journey. And also, I know we're just talking about X-Men, but the thing it reminds me of is Days of Future Past, where the X-Men go back in time to make sure that X3 never happened. This movie does the very important job of retconning out that the song that united everybody was by Kiss.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. And I think the movie, I was like surprised. One thing that surprised me about the movie, and I think why the last half hour or so I sort of keyed into it a little more than kind of the in and out fitful amusement, because I didn't even think about like, Kristen Schaal is in this movie, and I like again just did not find much of anything she was doing funny. And I think she's very funny. I just like every time they cut back to her, I was like, no, why? And again, I like her. It was more like this movie's very crowded, and I don't really want not watching a Bill and Ted movie to see like a fifth person's or sixth person if you're including death do like okay shtick about her mom. But one thing that keyed me into it more in the last half an hour is that I never really thought of the earlier movies as being particularly about music or music fandom, because it's a pretty narrow, it's like just like, oh, they're metalheads, they like their guitar solos and they are bad at music. And this one, the kind of omnivorous sensibility that their daughter is evince, I found really sweet. And like they just that, like, it felt like more keyed into what music can mean to people in a weird way. And that was not something I was expecting at all, because the other movies have just sort of been like a guitar solo triumphant. And this was like, although they actually like, they did, you know, they can't get away from actually needing to use music in the end thing. And like, it does sound like to my ears, like some, you know, like Imagine Dragons type shit, which was not pleasing to me, but like the general aesthetic of like just the daughter is shit, like kind of taking Bill and Ted's love of music and doing something more with it, and like that something that's more expansive and more, you know, even more pure than Bill and Ted, who are freighted with this responsibility that they have to write something really great or do something really world-changing. I did find that really sweet and warm. I didn't like find it like, you know, super funny, but I was surprised in the Bill and Ted movie of all places to have like a pretty nuanced and like nice portrayal of music fandom, which is something that music or that movies I don't find are very good at portraying, or outside of a couple like Almost Famous or High Fidelity. So I had that aspect of it, and I thought of you, Rob, even because it was such like a music, suddenly such like a music nerd movie, even though it's the references are very strange.
Yeah, no, I am not the first person to bring this up, but you know, yeah, the fact that the girls like knew what they were talking about, you know, Nathaniel was part of a bunch of Twitter conversations where like it was so heartening to hear them like compliment Bill and Ted about their song at the beginning of the movie, and like specifically mention like Clara Rockmore on the theremin. And like it feels like, so you know, the first two movies happen in quick succession. What happened between then, and what happened was that they spent, you know, all this time like raising their daughters. And, you know, the fact that they're like cool people who, you know, yeah, have like kind of authentic reactions to this stuff. I did think it was like a little, you know, it was like a little shticky that like they both have like the speech patterns of their parents. Although I will tell you, I did say to my daughter yesterday, get a job, in a way that reminded my aunt of my father. And I couldn't refute it.
Yeah, I mean, that part of it to me was like, I hear myself say things like, oh, that's exactly how my dad would say something. And I don't have a dad who's like, nobody has a dad who's like as iconic and fun to play as like Bill or Ted. So like, yeah, like I would be shaking my head and waving my arms the same way that Keanu does if I was related to him.
And that's part of the fun of it. Like, it's as
yeah,
much
like
as
the... not that to me. It's the fact that if those were real people now, they'd just be like TikTok teens.
Yeah, they do the daughters do kind of exist out of time, even more so than Bill and Ted in Bogus Journey, where it's like, I was like, how old are they? Are they 17 or
are they
28?
The same age as the recast moms?
I guess they're closer to 28 or whatever, because it's 30 years or so after.
Yeah, I think Ted's dad says something about they're like 24 and living at home, but which is like kind of fudging it because it's been 29 years.
Yeah.
I do want to back Marissa up on one thing, because while I disagreed with almost all of her other criticisms, like not only did they recast the moms their wives in this movie, they recast them in the second movie too. Like it's in terms of like how kind of like nice and gentle like this movie is, like that it is a harsh reminder that like,
especially because they bring everybody else back. Like,
yeah, they brought back Missy and they gave her like a longer backstory.
And this weird implication that no, you need someone younger and prettier to be believably married to like two, like, you know, 50
right.
something
and, like,
washouts.
Thing, like, I know we always talk about like how positive they are, but it's like they, in the beginning of the movie, they're supposedly miserable. They go on this journey that you don't see and you don't like experience with them, and decide that this miserable experience is like the best that is for them, the best that's out there for them. It's not, that doesn't make me happy.
I do kind of wish they had more scenes with the daughters, because that's like, an emotional thing, I feel like was, if not shortcutted, like a little, I feel like it could have hit me a little harder if they had, you know, shared a little more screen space with them rather than giving, I like that they have their own sort of little adventure, but it
they don't really have their own little adventure. Like, you're told that they have their own little adventure. But
the daughters? Well, you see
some... the moms I'm talking about.
Oh, the mom. Right. Yeah. Oh, well, that too. Yeah, that I found sort of a baffling distraction to have them doing something else off camera. Yeah.
So we're going to pivot to trilogies at large.
Yeah.
So if this is the trilogy, what are you comparing it to as, like, your ultimate trilogy?
Well, this is a weird one because it's in the...
Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, Marissa. What else? Yeah,
the only one that matters.
Can I just say one thing? I saw Excellent Adventure in the theater, and none of you have, so I'm going to lord that over all of you before we move to trilogies.
Marissa is the realist, because I was just still seeing, like, The Little Mermaid.
Well, you know, my dad got to decide. They did not take me back for Bogus Journey.
Into your family fashion, you know, you skip all the sequels. This is, like, you know, this is a special category of movies that became trilogies much later. And I would, like, there's also movies that are no longer trilogies because of a fourth entry that came much later. So there aren't, you know, necessarily that many that like are still standing as really good and it's not changed into something else by there being an additional movie. Nathaniel brainstormed a very large list, and some of them are even still pending. Like, The Matrix is not going to be a trilogy as of 2022, I think it is. So in terms of, and the comedy sequels and trilogies are even more rare. Like, I can't offhand think of the Hangover trilogy, which is starts off bad and gets fucking awful. It's like, I could, yeah, you guys think of, like, I get Austin Powers.
There's Austin Powers. I also think, like a gold standard for me is obviously, it's obvious to me that, like, Back to the Future.
Yeah, we talked about that in our...
And, like, that one also specifically, in particular, because it, like, that one will not be, like, they're not going to get, there's not going to be a 40 years later fourth entry to that one, which is, like, kind of reassuring. Like, that one, you can kind of look at it and go, okay, that's a trilogy. It's over, and it's, like, maybe they'll remake it someday, but they're not going to, you know.
It's,
like,
not going to be a part four, most likely.
Yeah.
At least not one that feels meaningfully a part four.
Yeah, like, Zemeckis and Gale explicitly don't want to do it. Michael J. Fox is, you know, not likely to be to play Marty McFly again. Christopher Lloyd has got to be in his 80s now.
It's, and then, like, well, like, Wayne's World is sort of the contemporary of Bill and Ted, and that seemed like it would have a strong, you know, had a huge hit, and then a sequel the next year, and then it like, you know, I still wouldn't count out them doing another Wayne's World in the future, because I feel like that's Mike Myers seems to go to, like, okay, well, maybe we'll do another Austin Powers, maybe we'll do another Wayne's World, but, like, more indicative of how these things usually go, even with, like, the second Wayne's World is quite good, and it just, you know, it didn't happen. So to think of comedy ones, Back to the Future is like, you know, adventure / comedy / fantasy, and also involves time travel like this one, but the other ones tend to be more like science fiction or fantasy.
You haven't answered my question, and Rob hasn't answered my question. The best trilogy doesn't have to be comedy.
I mean, yeah, but in terms of, like, consistency of quality, besides Back to the Future, like, I like all the Star Wars movies, but although I would say the last trilogy doesn't necessarily hang together that well as a trilogy. The Dark Knight ones, obviously.
So you pick the trilogy with 9 movies in it? That's
three trilogies.
But what about those other movies?
Yeah, I mean, that's not... They're still, like... Okay. They're still an original trilogy or prequel trilogy.
You know, trilogy means three.
Yeah, I know. I understand. But are you really don't believe that those things are considered trilogies?
Okay, so your favorite trilogy is all the Star Wars
trilogies. Or, yeah, probably that's my favorite. But, like, I think The Dark Knight is remarkably consistent, though people don't like the third one as much. I like it a lot.
Rob, do you have a choice?
I think in terms of consistency across the board, and I know I'm the only person that thinks this, I would go with the Oceans trilogy.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
you
good.
Would pick that.
I would, yes. This is why people come to sportsalcohol.com.
To read Rob's Ocean 12 takes. That's a good one, though. That's one where they feel relatively distinct from each other, but also are very much of a piece.
Evan, you already kind of mentioned mine, Jesse, which is The Dark Knight. I'm not going to let, like, awful Nolan fans back me off of this choice, but I do think that they tell a story related to one theme. They leave it open enough so that you could do other Batman movies, and they not fucked with this one. It's like a same director, same tone, same, well, mostly same cast throughout. And it's, yeah, that's like kind of what I hope that trilogies are when trilogies are announced.
I, like, a question I was curious about, since we, like, I feel like we'd all mostly agree, like, that the Nolan Batman movies are good, that Back to the Future is good, Star Wars
Back to the Future is great.
Yeah. And we all, I think, like the Ocean's movies pretty much. Are there, can we think of one, because, like, the third one, like, the Bill and Ted third movie seems like it's getting, I don't know if the really positive notices it's getting are saying it's the best of the three, because I think people have a lot of affection for that first one. But that's rare.
Oh, but
right?
You, this crazy group all is like voting for Bogus Journey as their favorite? What the fuck?
It's the funniest
I
one.
I don't know if Nathaniel specifically said that.
I didn't say it was my favorite. I said when I was younger, I preferred it to Excellent Adventure. Mm-hmm.
I think it's funnier and cleverer than the first one, if that's, you know,
if you like that,
if that's your bag,
if you think it's really funny for something to be like Stacia,
but yeah, it's harder to find one where the third one is the one everyone loves, and so I was curious if people had like third installments they wanted to go to bat for
besides Back to the Future 3.
Yeah, because I mean, you like
Back to
the Future 3.
About Back to the Future 3.
Sure, but do you like it the best of the three?
No, the best of the three.
Or even, you know,
no,
contender.
No, I would say it's like
the,
on
for...
par, but no, definitely not best.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Looking over this list that Nathaniel provided, there are two that kind of stick out because they're primarily independent movies, so things radically change from movie to movie in terms of story, in terms of in terms of production values, in terms of who owns the rights, and those are the Mariachi trilogy and the Evil Dead trilogy. The Evil Dead movies, it feels like it's kind of hard to even compare them because they kind of have this tradition of kind of they're almost not like direct sequels because they have the second and third one have like those recaps in front at the start of the movie. And also they're all kind of very different in terms of tone. And then the Mariachi one, I really, really like every one of those movies, but they're so different for so many reasons. You know, El Mariachi famously made for very little money, but still is like this nice, tight, little action movie. And then, like, Desperado is, like, the movie where, like, it becomes, like, a little more fully fleshed. It is just super 90s in a lot of ways. It's hard to describe. But then, like, the last one is, like, this epic that kind of, like backloads, like, some Mexican nationalism and one of Johnny Depp's, like, most insane performances. Those are very, like, those two trilogies are very interesting to me just because they're really kind of all over the place.
Yeah, and I think you could make an argument at least. I think maybe that's probably the popular consensus, but I would make the argument that Once Upon a Time in Mexico is the best of the three, or at least you can make a case for it pretty strongly, which is harder to do for even like Dark Knight Rises, which I think is awesome, Back to the Future 3, which I think is awesome. Like, I don't think I can make the case for either of them being the best of those three.
Well, you know, the one that I make the case for all the time, although it's not only a trilogy anymore, is Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Okay, wait, so you're going to bring up Die Hard, which is fully five movies, but people talking about the individual Star Wars trilogies isn't okay.
Because you can erase the other movies that came after Die Hard with a Vengeance from the record.
You can, but
And then I would say the other one, which is like in the same situation where it is no longer a trilogy, but I like the third one the best. And I know that everyone's gonna jump down my throat, is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It's got the best. Both of them have the best puzzles. What's your choice?
Yeah, Rob brought up Evil Dead. I think now probably Evil Dead 2 would be my favorite of them. But when I was a kid, the like knucklehead Harryhausen of Army of Darkness was like really my cup of tea. I mean, like the Clint Eastwood Dollars, you know, Sergio Leone trilogy, like The Good, the Mad, the Ugly is pretty hard to, I'm sure there are people who are like the purity of Fistful of Dollars is, you know, superior or something, but like The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly is I think, like, the best of those three. But yeah, because it's tough, because I, like, there are the ones where it's kind of a single story told throughout, and the third doesn't necessarily have to be the best, it's just got to be satisfying. And then there's others where there's, yeah, like, real variability in quality. And yeah, the way that Star, I feel like it was, like, seems pretty clear Star Wars was what said, like, everything's a trilogy now for a while. And then I don't know if it was the prequels or what it was that said, like, okay, all your trilogies, just keep going. Because, you know, like, when we were of the age where we were kids, there were, like, a bunch of different movie trilogies. And now, you know, that list is, like, pretty diminished because there's, like, fourth or fifth entries or sixth or seventh entries of all of these things.
But I feel like there is something mystical about the number three, because as hard as it is to find one where the part three is the best one, it's, like, really hard to find a good part four of anything.
Well, I would say, you know, Mad Max.
Mad Max, but it's, like, you can call it the fourth Mad Max, but it's really its own movie.
It does feel like a part.
Like, you don't have to have seen any of the other
Mad Maxes.
Part
of what's successful about it is the way that it's many years later, and it kind of behaves accordingly.
Right, and that's it. Like, Mad Max, period.
Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes is one of the coolest Planet of the Apes.
I love Toy Story 4, actually. That, like, I don't, like, I have no sense of in the world whether that, I know it was really successful, but I have no sense of, like, whether it, you know, it generally was received as being, like, you know, because of course when it was announced, I was like, ugh, they finished their trilogy. But I ended up really loving the fourth one, so...
Yeah, I think it's regarded, you know, similarly to three. Like, some people prefer three, and some people prefer four. But a lot of those people also like one or two even better. But it certainly isn't considered, like, a legacy ruiner. I think some people, like, my sense a year and change out is that some people found it kind of, like, minor. But I found that kind of charming about it, that it was, you know, felt like a little postscript rather than a...
Yeah,
than
I feel like it kind of, like, re-answered some of the questions that were answered in Toy Story 3 about, like, what happens when the toy remains and the kid moves on. But it also had Forky, which...
and it, yeah, it's like...
Well, it has different answers, I think. Like... The answer, it re-answers that for, you know, like, Buzz and his crew, but, like, the way it resolves for Woody is, like, to me really felt like genuinely, like, oh, they had a new thing to tell with this movie that they hadn't done in the previous one.
Yeah, especially if you look at the kind of parenting line through it, it's like a, you know, it's the empty nest one after the kid goes off to college.
It's the empty nest one after the other empty nest one.
Well, the third one is, like, before, you know, brings
you... Have another kid.
Yeah, yeah, the emptying of the nest. Yeah, actually, yeah, the justice for Andy's little sister.
I do feel like once you bring in the part four, it's when people say, like, why do they have to do this? This was already fine as it was.
Yeah,
say that after the part two is done and the part three is announced. I don't know if we're just, like, expect trilogies.
Yeah, can you guys think of any where the third one is sort of the ruining factor? I mean, like, I'm always reluctant to say ruining, because movies don't ruin other movies. The movies always exist, like, but you know what I mean when I say ruining factor anyway. Like, where the third one is like, oh man, that was the part four style bridge too far.
I mean, I think that, like, it didn't do it for me. I don't prefer it by any stretch, but, like, I feel like Scream 3 kind of landed that way a little bit, like, at the time. And then they did Scream 4 anyway, a while later. But I feel like at the time that was kind of the one that was like, okay, you have your trilogy, but really you didn't do it with this one.
I feel like the consensus on Glass actually is that it does that.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think that movie rules. So, like,
yeah,
right.
I feel like the classic answer to this, though, is The Godfather 3.
Yeah.
I endeavored to watch The Godfather 3 to see if I had a take on this, but I have not done so yet. But yeah, I think that's indicative of also of its place in the world, where it was actually a hit movie and got Oscar nominations and everything.
And I don't even think it's terrible. I think it's if it wasn't The Godfather, it'd be like a fine mob movie.
It's like a second tier one.
I think it also... Like, on the level. I think they also really... should have just paid Robert Duvall whatever he wanted to come back, because, like, it does make it feel a little bit more kind of, like, divorced from the previous two and a little more of just, like, a postscript that he's not in it, that it's like really Pacino and Diane Keaton are the like real continuity.
Yeah, like so the reason I've like seen both Godfather movies in the theater, and actually they're two of the movies I saw with Nathaniel first, is that they re-released them when the Blu-rays came out with like these remastered, and they like did remaster three for the Blu-ray. I have the Blu-rays with all three. But they did not put it back into theaters.
They're like, not even on a Tuesday morning.
Yeah, like, I would have gone to see it at the Ziegfeld, certainly, and they decided to...
Just have Andy Garcia.
Yeah. You and my mom both will like that.
I also have a weird answer for this one, which is the Beverly Hills Cop trilogy, because I liked Beverly Hills Cop 2.
Wait, okay. Interesting. I've actually only seen part of one, so I have no... but my
Three is terrible.
I kind of heard that about two, and what I saw of one I didn't care for either, so maybe I would just, it would be like a Hangover style wash for me.
Two spends a lot, it feels like it spends a lot more time with like his sidekick detectives who are actually stationed in Beverly Hills, and like their lives seem bad, and it's kind of funny to me.
It was one that's like no longer going to be a trilogy, and I wouldn't even come close to saying the third one is the best. And in fact, it's probably is the worst. But I feel like it gets a more bad rap than its other sequel is Matrix Revolutions.
Yeah,
which I feel like people don't like the Matrix sequels, but some will allow like, all right, well, Matrix Reloaded is like pretty cool. It's not, it's like doesn't end up doing that much story wise, but like I like the truck chase or whatever.
The Merovingian.
They like parts of it and say, okay, well, at least there was still potential there. And Matrix Revolutions is where it really fucks up. But I think there's like lots of really cool stuff in Revolutions, and it's like not really appreciably worse than Matrix Reloaded, which is...
Yeah, I think that's just like the kind of story freight lands on the third one. Like,
Stuff
they don't like about the second two gets attached to the third one, because like... The second one, you can at least just be like, well, it's the ball hasn't dropped yet. It's still in the air.
We've punted, yeah. Oh, and
or like my friend calls it the parts with the sweaters. He doesn't like the parts with the sweaters.
There's a lot of parts of the sweaters in the third one. Watching them as a whole, it is two that ends with on like the shittiest cliffhanger ever, where it's like, maybe Agent Smith is in a human body now or something. It's not really clear. Anyway, Matrix 3 coming soon.
Which is funny because this is also Keanu Reeves and a Weaving.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So, that's right. God, I didn't even think about Samara Weaving.
Wait, so are we going on to like part three that no one likes but us? Because I will do Alien 3.
Sure.
That movie fucking rules. It is not a legacy rumor.
But it's not. It's also not a trilogy anymore, because they came up with one that people like even less.
Yes,
because
now there's between four and six, seven movies.
Yeah, depending on, I mean, like Spider-Man 3 is like the weakest of the three, and also I would say is pretty awesome.
Rules.
Yes. So I feel like I'm finding mostly that like I'm pretty easy on a lot of part threes that people hate, but also at the same time, I can never find the one where I'm like, oh, but I'll go to bat and say the third one is the best one. Like my go-tos for that are always like, are actually just back to Star Wars. Like I think Revenge of the Sith is like the best of the three prequels, though it's not my favorite. And I think Return of the Jedi is my favorite of the three originals, even though it's not the best. And then the sequel trilogy, they're both the same, and it's Last Jedi. I don't have to worry as much about what I like. Agreed. The third one, but it's not the same deal. I don't know. So I was like curious, like, what is it? Like, what is it? How do you, like, what makes a good one with these things?
I do feel like even though the third, I think it's what Nathaniel said about The Matrix. It's like, the third one doesn't have to be the best one. It just has to be the one that satisfies the story to make me feel good about it. And I feel like that's what the ones that come back after so many years just kind of, like, make me feel unsatisfied. I feel like every time one's announced, I'm like, no, just, like, leave it. Just leave it the way it was. I didn't want this to be reopened. And maybe that's how I felt about Bill and Ted.
That you just wanted left at the...
But yeah, like, think of a different time travel story, which...
Well, that's what I was saying, like, this moment in time is the one where I'm like, yes, a Bill and Ted movie, that makes sense. Like, you know, if this was 10 years ago, I'd be like, what is going on? And if it was 10 years before that, I'd be like, well, no.
They just lay in wait for it to make sense.
Just going back to The Matrix real quick, I think the thing that bothers me about the sequels is the thing that bothers me about trilogies in general, where it's like they were the Wachowskis were like very lucky to get the budget and the actors and the buy-in or whatever to make The Matrix. And then after that, you know, I don't know who made the decision, if it was them or the producers or the studio, where they were like, okay, this is a trilogy now. So all trilogy, and you know, we mentioned this before, like Star Wars is just like, okay, we do trilogies now. So it's like the first one was its own movie, and then part two and three are just going to be like a continuation of that story. So you kind of get the thing with like the YA adaptations where like the last book is two movies. It kind of has that feel to it for me.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. There's a long history, and some of them are even good. You know, there's like Back to the Future 2 and 3 are very distinct like movies, but they were shot back to back and kind of conceived back to back. The Pirates 2 and 3, back when that was a trilogy, the Pirates of the Caribbean, those are pretty continuous. I mean, there's distinct things about them, but it's like there's the first one and then there's the next two, which kind of go together more so. Like the first one ends pretty, you know, ends fine.
Well, yeah, they decided that's one similar to like The Matrix or Back to the Future, where they were like, okay, we're not just gonna like we're not going to serialize this. We're not going to, you know, like just do discrete adventures. This is a trilogy, and we're going to like take the first one and kind of like build the finished trilogy on top of it.
Like the second one has to end on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, in a way that like, you know, like the Raimi Spider-Man movies are just three movies. And like the third one is like, to me, kind of, some of the places it suffers is when it's trying to say like, this is the end of a trilogy.
Yeah.
You know, and like kind of having to sort of like awkwardly bolt in kind of retcons or explanations or things like that to turn it into a trilogy. Whereas like Spider-Man 2 is clearly just like the next Spider-Man movie. It's not setting up a story that will lead you from part one to part three.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It's like I'm going to use this as an opportunity to knock on a bunch of like conventional wisdom that popped up with the most recent Star Wars movies, was that like, oh, the reason, you know, like this is just shows they didn't plan it. Like, you got to plan these things out. You got to plan it meticulously. And I feel like, I guess you could take that lesson from some of what we're talking about, where there's a first movie that stands on its own, and then they append a second and third to make it a trilogy. But those things are usually planned out pretty, you know, it's obviously Pirates 1 and Back to the Future 1 were not like planned with a trilogy in mind, but like, you know, that's plenty of lead time if you're saying, okay, we can construct a second and third with the idea of doing a trilogy. And sometimes they're quite good. I love Back to the Future. I know Nathaniel's a big fan of the Pirates trilogy, but it's not like, I feel like the kind of broad track record is not like one of great fan satisfaction when that happens. Like the Matrix sequels are not well regarded. The Pirate sequels, I think, have kind of a mixed reputation. Even Back to the Future 2 and 3 for a long time were not that well loved. So this notion that you have to plan it all out, which I always thought was such a bullshit way of talking about whatever problems you have with the Star Wars sequel trilogy, like, to me, it's kind of counterintuitive. I think it's actually opposite. I think it's, though, it, you know, even with Spider-Man 3, you could say that didn't pay off because they kind of half and half try to do that in the third one, and it's like Nathaniel said, that's the stuff that works least well about the movie. But like, and I think people had that complaint about Dark Knight Rises too, that it like, it didn't like, you know, build on Dark Knight in a way that it felt like, oh, they were planning this all along, and it's like they weren't. And I think that's why I like it, because it's like three movies that fit together very well. But I don't think like that. There's just this weird fetishization.
I feel like it's a TV thing.
Of like we're gonna plan it all out and it'll be perfect. And
I mean,
like,
I think it's also it's a George Lucas thing. Like he, I think, you know, even not always honestly, you know, I think, you know, kind of just in the mythologizing of the original Star Wars trilogy, talked about it as being this like, you know, he had an enormous screenplay and he took a chunk of it and made Star Wars out of it, and then, you know, like just made the rest of it to make Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, which is not true. It's not what happened.
He's just ripping off Tolkien again.
There is like a kernel in there of like, there was at least one person who had like a notion of what he wanted the story to be.
Yeah.
And I think like, to me, I don't think they needed to have like a beat by beat outline. I think that's like, you know, that's kind of taking the mythology over what actually happened to make it work of the original Star Wars. But I do think that like there is a difference in, you know, like Irvin Kershner directed the second one of that original series and Richard Marquand directed the third, but George Lucas was the one sitting on top of everybody in for those movies saying like, this is what this kind of story is about. And he obviously didn't have the second and third movies figured out when he made Star Wars, but there was a point of view and a continuity of kind of vision of what the story was going to be. And like, again, not in specifics of like the story is that Luke gets his hand cut off in the second movie. And then in the third movie, you know, has a green lightsaber and then meets Jabba the Hutt. And like, it's not that, but he did, you know, he did know like, I want this to be a story about, you know, like a kind of kid who discovers his place in this grand conflict and is tested in a particular way. And then eventually, you know, he hit upon the notion that it was like, you know, him actually confronting his father. And again, even that wasn't something that he had in mind necessarily when that first movie was made, but there was one person, you know, or him and, you know, Gary Kurtz or whoever you want to attribute to sort of the kind of creative brain trust of that series. But there was like a continuity of vision. And so the person changing his mind was still the person who kind of was the one telling the story.
Yeah.
In a way that I think like that's, I think what, when people are complaining about, you know, J.J. Abrams coming in and reversing Rian Johnson or Rian Johnson coming in and reversing J.J. Abrams, it was more just that like, it seemed like they really were given, both of those guys were given the thing that people claim they want, which is give it to a filmmaker and let them make a movie. Like, don't dictate it to them. Don't have top down. Don't have like an outline that they're working from. They were just allowed to go and write what they wanted to do. And I don't know, maybe J.J. Abrams had more pressures on the third one because it had like a release date and. And
it sounds like there was some, yeah,
you know, a kind of overall corporate thing going on. But yeah, I think that like, you know, the Back to the Future, it was Zemeckis and Gale made those three movies and they made them into a trilogy and it was great, you know. And then like the new Planet of the Apes trilogy, which is a trilogy and tells the story of Caesar, but did not have, you know, like it wasn't the same writers from the first to the third. And it wasn't, you know, Matt Reeves came in and did the second and third, but he wasn't involved in the first one at all. And that one was, it is kind of Exquisite Corpse together and it hang together really well.
I'd honestly like to see more like that. I think though I enjoyed Rise of Skywalker, part of me feels like the solution was probably a third filmmaker and that it just wasn't, the third person being back to JJ,
yeah,
and it wasn't
like my,
and it wasn't Colin
my beloved Alien series. Like every filmmaker got for a while, every filmmaker got to do their own take on like what the xenomorph
until,
means to
until
them.
Ridley Scott.
Yeah, but I also think that in addition to what Nathaniel said, it is like an audience trained by prestige TV, like with these like prestige showrunners saying like this isn't a season of a show; it's slices of a 10-hour movie. That what's prized above all is like paying off the big story and not really the satisfaction of like the individual story units. That's not how I like my life. And when things get too serialized, I get really annoyed. But I do think that like audiences have been trained for like to look for the big story.
Well, it's so interesting that the big ones, the biggest of these movies when, in terms of like popularity released or dollars or whatever, are often the second one, the one that follows the first one where the first one was a huge hit and there's always people going, oh, I can't wait to see the next one. But the third one that's supposed to be paying things off that the second one, first/second one set up is not always the really big one, because I feel like the idea that the payoff thing that people are, I think that these things are made to provide or try to provide is not actually, it's what people are looking for is much more vague and like ineffable than, will this pay off the cliffhanger from Dead Man's Chest?
They wanted to pay off the cliffhanger and have it be a twist.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of it really, I feel, is conditioned. Like, the internet was like perfectly designed to disseminate the sort of like fanboy understanding of how movies are made and stories are told, which was like created by, to a large extent, I feel like Lucasfilm mythologizing the creation of Star Wars, and that like that not went beyond fanboy circles, and now just like everybody feels like they know how stories are told and movies are made, because they have like internalized these sort of this sort of mythology about it. And then like so like the Indiana Jones series is not a trilogy built around like a, you know, like Indiana Jones doesn't go through a journey the way that Luke Skywalker does. But when talking about it as a trilogy, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg talk about like, well, Empire Strikes Back was the darker second entry, and then the third one kind of Return of the Jedi returns to, you know, the kind of motifs of the original. So Indiana Jones as a trilogy, the second one is the darker journey into the dark heart, even though it's in Indiana Jones, it's a prequel and it's not going on a journey, you know, like... And then the third one is a return to the desert.
Even though it's dark, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the third one is a return to the desert. And like, that's, it's just a series of three adventure movies,
yeah,
right? But it's talked about as a trilogy, and people just like internalize that. And then like, you know, so that's the case with every trilogy has to have that structure, right? That's like second, it's not people who read Journey of, you know, Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. It's people who heard George Lucas talk about it, or who heard someone on YouTube talk about George Lucas talking about it. So it's like internalized as this, like, this is the structure of a trilogy and the structure of storytelling. And it's just like, that's not how these things are, you know, like, it's not how they're built. Even the original Star Wars trilogy, which George Lucas did, you know, have The Hero of a Thousand Faces in mind, still didn't hammer out this, you know, the outline that said in the third movie there's another Death Star. Like, it was
it was the time-honored tradition of the second Death Star, right. Which JJ, okay, then time-honored tradition honored in there has to be a second Death Star. Rob, you have your hand up.
I'm sorry, yeah, I have like 3 points I need to, yes, make. First of all,
a trilogy of points.
The second one's the darkest.
Nathaniel describing, actually, the first one's the darkest. Nathaniel describing how Lucas mythologizes Star Wars, and how Spielberg and Lucas talk about the Indiana Jones movies being like part of this grand plan.
And I love those guys in those movies, don't get me wrong.
Yeah. But no, there's some hucksterism going on. And what it really reminds me of is the episode of Difficult People where Jules cons herself to get a writing job on a show by her ex-boyfriend, played by Patton Oswalt, who keeps talking about story diamonds, which I am led to believe is a parody of Dan Harmon.
Right.
And, you know, I think that this stuff falls on a spectrum. So you talked about it being like a Lucas thing. You talked about it being a prestige thing. I think the reductio ad absurdum thing on the end of the spectrum is the Marvel thing. And that's where you really see the problems. And also, I love those movies. Like, you know, I grew up reading Marvel comic books, and I'm just, you know, I'm not saying they should win awards or anything, but I'm just going to keep watching them until they go the way of the cowboy picture. You know, I think that since that's like the most heightened version of this, it really highlights the detriments of planning this all out, which is that you don't have individual movies. And I think it's a bigger problem when you do this with movies than when you do it with TV shows, because TV shows nowadays, it's like, oh yeah, there's going to be 12 episodes in a row. There won't be any, you know, there won't be any reruns in between. And then that'll be done. Like with movies, it's like, okay, we'll see you in 2 years. So that should be its own, like, you know.
But even the Marvel thing is so mythologized, I think. Like,
oh, totally.
That there's like this binder that Kevin Feige carries around that's got the next 10 years of movies meticulously planned out is just like not borne out by the way that any of these movies, like when you hear people talk about when they were hired and how they came onto these movies and who wrote what and when.
Completely agreed, but still, you still have things like Edgar Wright walking off because, like, they need to take you know, like 10, 15 minutes of this movie he's been working on for years to talk about Infinity Stones or whatever. Like, so it's like, they're still like, yeah, they're it's not as tightly planned out as we thought. I think I mentioned in a previous podcast how, like, basically part of the reason that, like, they went into the Iron Man film with no script is, like, they had a bunch of comic book writers come up and be like, none of this shit works. Why are you doing the Mandarin? Like, don't do that. Like, but then they're still trying to have it both ways. And then, like Marvel is actually, like, a fairly, like, good outcome. Like, the bad outcomes are like a, you know, like a Mummy movie with a Dark Universe logo in front of it, or, you know, everybody going to see Batman v Superman opening weekend and making a ton of money. All those people being like, what happened to that movie? It's not very good. And Warner Brothers going, okay, we got the box office we need for the first weekend to green light the Justice film movie. Start shooting right now. You know? So yeah, you just let these things be their own thing. And, you know, I think that there are people who are much harsher about this than we are, where they're just like, stop it with the sequels, with the trilogies. It's like, eh, you can have a sequel as a treat, you know, but, you know, just let the experience of the movie you saw by itself, you know, gestate with you maybe a year or so. And then, like, yeah, if you want these characters to show up again, you know, that would be fine. It reminds me of watching Siskel and Ebert review Ang Lee's The Wedding Banquet, and two thumbs up, obviously, but, like, their most positive comment was, like, I would like to see these characters take on some other sort of challenge.
Well, you know, that sort of brings to something I was thinking about, is I feel like this is, like, not to be, like, a super, like, my favorite trilogies or these things that aren't really trilogies at all, but I am, like, as I've gotten older, become a big fan of, like, the sort of the unofficial trilogy, because it does, you know, it kind of gets away from those studio expectations, audience expectations. And Rob, I think you're right. Like, I think Rob and Nathaniel, you're both very right about this. Like, it's sort of become what we used to attribute to studio fear, in terms of, like, oh, they want to make a sequel and recapture something, but they're so terrified of what, you know, of how big it could be and how big it might not be if they don't do it right, has, like, weirdly also sort of transferred to a kind of audience/fan fear. Like, they're also sort of afraid of what they might get if it's not going to be the right thing that they had envisioned as their, like, you know, based on their stupid fucking screenwriting textbooks or YouTube videos. So they're equally afraid of getting something that's not, that is, you know, not to, like, beat a dead horse, but, like, that is, like, The Last Jedi, that, like, that frightens, like, a fair number of fans. But I'm, like, one way to sidestep those kind of expectations and also sidestep the kinds of movies that always get sequels and get trilogized or whatever are, like, the things that happen completely accidentally and that the filmmakers wouldn't even say they are trilogies. Like, I always talk about the Say Anything and Gross Point Blank and High Fidelity are, like, the John Cusack trilogy of, like, kind of, you know, growing up and maturing, even though those characters aren't, you know, it's common ground, but they're obviously not the same character. It's not even, there actually is, like, an unofficial Gross Point Blank sequel called War Inc., where it's not the same character, but it's kind of patterned after, meant to be a companion piece. And I don't rate that at all, but those three Cusack movies, like, feel like, oh, this is kind of a piece to me, like, even though they're different, they're three different directors and doing three different things. And I was wondering if you guys have other things like that, where you sort of, like, think of, like, oh yes, these three movies by this director or these three movies with this actor that, like, go together despite not being grandly conceived as a money-making endeavor.
I mean, I think the this is almost cheating because it is intentional and they've been branded as such, but the Edgar Wright's Coronado trilogy.
There you go.
And I don't even like Shaun of the Dead that much, but it's just like Edgar Wright getting to do his thing, and that, you know, that just feels good.
Yeah, and there's, like, a progression there that doesn't have to be based on plot. That's sort of based on the filmmaker and the actors. That's not, you know, you don't have to deal with, like, what was the plot point from Shaun of the Dead and how this is being capitalized and Hot Fuzz. It's not, but it does kind of read as a, as,
yeah, the World's End is literally about, like, grappling with, like, growing up.
Yeah.
It's hard because I live with you, so I know all of yours. Like the Soderbergh body commodification trilogy of
ooh, what a good one.
Girlfriend Experience, Magic Mike, and Haywire. Or like the Spielberg sci-fi trilogy that's Minority Report, War of the Worlds, and AI.
Yeah.
Those are both good ones, Jesse.
Thanks. Wow.
I feel like maybe Spielberg's also got His like obviously War of the Worlds in Munich, and then I don't know, maybe the Terminal is the third of those, like
the 9/11 trilogy.
Yeah.
Well, he has like a civic responsibility. I think, does he have a civic responsibility trilogy yet? With
Post Bridge of Spies,
Lincoln, and then and Lincoln. Yeah, that's kind of a thing. He has so many that can be combined in fun ways. Like I'm sure you could do something with Jaws, Jurassic Park.
I think it's like I don't know,
Saving Private Ryan and Amistad.
Yeah, yeah.
The Coen's idiot trilogy.
Well, now that's they de-trilogized that, didn't they? Or did they? How have they done?
The third one never got made, maybe.
Or no, Hail Caesar is it's Oh Brother and
Terrible Cruelty,
and Hail Caesar, and Hail Caesar sort of came out as being more of an ensemble thing than.
But you can imagine that the Clooney characters are like related.
Yeah,
they're ancestors of each other.
Yeah, yeah.
They got to do old things so they can have the Capital Pictures trilogy.
Oh yeah, there you go. Yeah, I think those, you know, there's a reason. I think it's fun to bring that to these things, and that like it's not as, you know, rigorously designed, and that carries over to even some that are more that we talked about that are more, you know, traditional sequels like the Mariachi 3 and the Evil Dead 3 movies. Like are not like tightly continuous. They like in fact contradict each other quite regularly, but they're of a piece, and that's like there's not the pressure of like how does the tree in Evil Dead get paid off in Evil Dead in Army of Darkness, and the answer is no.
So I think we should do a parting thoughts question, which is there something that stands at a 2 that you would like to see expanded into a 3? I will go first, and I will say no. I'm not as generous as Rob said we are. And I am the one that's like, let's stop going back to the well. I don't want my childhood sold to me over and over, so then I have to rebuy it, but I will always rebuy it.
Yeah, I just want it sold back to me, just like,
although I,
sometimes.
Growing up throughout my life, I thought that Ghostbusters 2 was Ghostbusters 3, and that there was a 2 I had never seen. But now there's like going to be 4 Ghostbusters movies, so that's...
Yeah. Yeah, Ghostbusters is the one where just defiantly I don't want there to be, like, I'm not excited about Ghostbusters Afterlife because I feel, I mean, maybe it's just the trailer, but it just seems like...
You also really hate Finn Wolfhard. I don't know what, it's just like he just gets under your skin.
He just, I don't think he's a good actor, but, you know, the reverence that was, I saw in the trailer for Ghostbusters Afterlife is, like, all wrong to me about what, it's like, everything with those... what those dum-dums didn't like, you know, or like, or looking forward to Ghostbusters movie. But just for out of stubbornness, like the fact that I'm with Bill Murray, like if he wants to undermine the existence of a Ghostbusters 3, then I think it deserves to be undermined. But so the obvious one, and Nathaniel mentioned on his, Nathaniel had a very strong list of twofers that aren't yet trilogies. And this is a more recent one, but they could wait, and they would have to wait because there's no demand for it. But I love Happy Death Day and Happy Death Day to You. And they were clearly, like, the second one does have a setup for a trilogy that I don't even know the idea they seem to have for the third one is all that good. So maybe some time, you know, if it does the typical, like, oh, well, no one wanted this, but then 10 or 15 years later, we decided that people want it. Maybe that would give them some time to rethink what Happy Death Day, there's a 3 in there somewhere, Happy Death 3 would be, because I think that would be fun to have. Like, there are just, you know, there are not that many horror movie franchises seem to like just either go on forever or they're cool one-offs, and so it'd be cool to actually have a horror, like a horror comedy trilogy to go with Evil Dead. That would be Happy Death Days.
Rob?
Looking over this list, because I couldn't think of any movies where like a sequel had recently come out and I'm like, I hope they make a third one. That's just because my brain is bad, because this has been a really tough year. So I thank you, Nathaniel, for this list. And the only one that like I saw where I was like, yeah, I'm fine with that would be Tron, because rewatching the first one, like I like, the older I get, the more I like it. It was like, I didn't really, when I was a kid, I didn't really appreciate what it was doing. And then Tron Legacy completely misses the point of the first movie, but like, and also because it's 10 years old, the de-aging technology has some real uncanny valley stuff, but like, still, like, I like that kind of on its own. And really the only thing that's holding me back is that I heard that Jared Leto was in talks to be in this. And my first thought when I heard that was, please don't anybody show him what they let Michael Sheen look like in Tron Legacy, because then it's all over.
They need to bring back Cillian Murphy.
I feel like I didn't like love Tron Legacy, but I did love watching it, and it was such a beautiful movie. And some of the beauty of it was that it was telling me that there was going to be a sequel that would have Cillian Murphy and Olivia Wilde. So very beautiful people and a beautiful movie.
Like, you can swim in those eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And so
also, you say you didn't love Tron, but like, you had a Tron summer. you drove around listening to
Daft Punk song. Yeah,
it was like Shapes and Colors.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'd be on board for a third Tron, but I agree. Like, the Leto thing is really, it's like,
apparently it's like not Tron 3. It's like another Tron movie with Jared Leto. Like,
oh boy.
I feel like it was reported as being like explicitly, this is not like the sequel to Tron Legacy, or like, you know, it's not going to have Olivia Wilde's character or,
I want a movie that like has like that kind of visual impressionistic style of the first one, but also like a completely CGI Jeff Bridges for no reason, because I've lost my mind.
I think, you know, it's just going to make us all, we're all going to be looking at it there like having Fight Club in mind, being like, we just want to destroy something beautiful. Fucking punch Jared Leto.
Nathaniel?
I feel like I've pitched a My Girl sequel.
I was hoping you'd mention this
in some past podcast, so I'm gonna like count that as having already been done. But like, you know, Anna Chlumsky is still around and great, and Dan Aykroyd and Jamie Lee Curtis are around, and like, I think it would be cool to see like what those characters are up to. And I don't remember if I ever pitched Crank 3.
Of all the ones on your list, that was the one that I was like, ooh.
Like, Crank 3, my original notion of like, oh, this is what they have to do, was something like the thing that he has to keep recharge. They give him like mechanical lungs or something, and he's in a space station. And he has to keep like recharging his lungs or something like that. Crank for sure. And then, like, inspired by this, like, Michael Keaton is going to be in the Flash movie thing. I feel like when we did our Tim Burton podcast, I like may have even explicitly been like, I don't want to see him like doing more like IP stuff, you know. But it now is dangling the notion of like, I would be into a Tim Burton, Michael Keaton, Batman movie where they like, I don't want them to have be beholden to anything. Like, if you're doing a multiverse, just let them make a movie, like a Batman movie in Tim Burton's Gotham City with whatever he wants to do. And like, don't tie it in at all, but just like, you're building your bridge already. So just like that, I would be into that.
Okay. So between you bringing up Michael Keaton and Jesse mentioning unofficial trilogies, I think I have a better answer. We need a third movie where Michael Keaton plays FBI agent Ray Nicolette.
Ooh, sure. Yeah.
Into it.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay, so I said I didn't like any of these, but I actually like all of your ideas this time. So they're all greenlit.
We'll sell it back to you.
Yeah.
Charge you $20 at least.
This is the problem. So yes, let us know your favorite trilogies or pitches for the third entries or fourth or fifth at Sports Alcohol.
Be excellent to each other.
Yeah, we'll revisit this when Frozen 3 drops. So we can have the kids on the
A poor man wants station.
Now I'm in the middle like a bird without a beak, because there's just two songs in me, and I just wrote the third. Don't know where I got the inspiration or how I wrote the words. Spent my whole life just digging up my music's shallow grave for the two songs in me, and the third one I just...